Chapter 15. Profile. Dr. Dorothy E. Denning. Over the decades, I've come to believe that one of my few special talents in the world of computer security is detecting malicious hackers and their activities. I'm able to see a potential hacker threat and then figure out how that threat could be detected better and earlier to generate alerts. I still think I can do it better than anyone in the world, but for a while I felt like I had some original thinking on intrusion/anomaly detection. I even sort of got a big head about it. Then I found out about Dr. Dorothy E. Denning's seminal IEEE paper on real-time intrusion detection expert systems. users.ece.edu/tilde-adrian/731-sp04/readings/denning-ids.pdf. It covered everything I thought I was doing original thinking on, except Dr. Denning wrote her paper in 1986, long before my own discovery. It was the first of many times when I would discover that my original thinking was not original at all. We all stand on the shoulders of giants, and Dr. Denning certainly belongs in the category of security giants. She was an early pioneer in computer security back when few people were working in the area. She told me, "There wasn't a computer security field to get into when I first started. There were no books, no journals you could read, and no conferences you could attend that were devoted to security. All we had to read were doctoral theses and a few papers published in more broadly focused conferences and journals, like the Communications of the ACM. But I was lucky to be at Purdue University, one of the few universities starting to do work in computer security, along with MIT and a few others." When she first started college, Dr. Denning enjoyed math and saw herself as being a high school mathematics teacher. While at the University of Michigan getting her BA in mathematics, she ended up working for the director of radio astronomy, who encouraged her to learn programming to solve some problems. In her senior year, she took one of the few computer science classes available anywhere. Later on, at the University of Rochester, she created a command language translator to make running programs on an IBM mainframe easier, and she developed and taught courses in programming languages and compilers. Her love of teaching led her to pursue a PhD at Purdue, where she took a course on operating systems from her eventual husband, Peter Denning. The course included principles of computer security at the OS level. This began her lifelong pursuit of improving information security. She even taught one of the first computer security courses that existed in the country. Note: Dr. Denning's translator took commands in Rochester's Easy Control language and translated them into IBM's Job Control language, which users found difficult to use. Dr. Denning earned her PhD in 1975. Creating the Lattice security model, which can be summarized as an information classification structure that forms a lattice so that information can only flow in one direction through the lattice, and only from lower to higher or equal classifications. The concept of one-way information flow still drives much of the original computer security thinking being developed today. Two of the recent projects I've been working on with Microsoft: Secure Admin Workstations, msdn.microsoft.com/n-us/library/mt186538.aspx, and Red Forest Enhanced Security Admin Environment, technet.microsoft.com/windows-server-docs/security/securing-privileged-access/securing-privileged-access-reference-material, are underlain by a strict information flow that follows the same rules. Dr. Denning's work expanded the lattice mathematical model into information protection. She told me, "I spent a lot of time thinking about data classification and protection. And when I came up with a model and math to go with it, I thought it was original. I shared my theorems and proofs with my husband, and he informed me it was called lattice theory, and told me the name of the expert, Garrett Birkhoff, who wrote the book on it. Up until then, I thought I had invented new math theory. Dr. Denning's story gave me a little solace about my own discovery. Dr. Denning published her paper, A Lattice Model of Secure Information Flow, faculty.nps.edu/dedenin/publications/lattice76.pdf, in 1976. It moved lattice theory into the information protection field. Her paper is full of simple explanations and math formulas, although it doesn't necessarily go into how a lattice model would be directly implemented in an operating system. Even though she never implemented it herself, her thesis and a later paper, faculty.nps.edu/dedenin/publications/certification-program-secure-info-flow.pdf, described how a compiler could be modified to check the flows of programs which others used to implement her model. One of the larger themes across Dr. Denning's work was protecting sensitive information even as it was processed by software processes. She said, "I think one of the examples cited is when you send your tax return to a tax preparation software or service for processing. They should be able to process your return without having sensitive information get into the hands of people that shouldn't have it." I asked her how she thought people's sensitive information was being handled today. She said, "Well, it's not being done well. Information is stolen all the time, and accessed by people who should not access it. Right now, many companies aren't doing enough to protect information." In 1982, Dr. Denning wrote an influential textbook, Cryptography and Data Security, amazon.com/cryptography-security-dorothy-elizabeth-roebling/dp/02011015005. The original reason she wrote the book is because she couldn't find the book she needed to teach a course on the subject. It was the first of several books and more than 170 articles and white papers that she would write over her career. In 1983, she started at SRI International, a nonprofit research institute established by Stanford University trustees, and began to work on intrusion detection for the Navy, which eventually culminated in the intrusion detection white paper I referenced at the beginning of the chapter. She moved to Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, which was a pretty hot computer company at the time, and where thousands of computer patents emanated from. It was during her time at DEC that she ended up interviewing a bunch of computer hackers to understand their motivations and psyches. Of course, more learnings and papers were the result. Simultaneously interviewing hackers and working to prevent their illegal activities created a bit of controversy at the time. Although she doesn't necessarily seek controversy, it's clear she doesn't avoid it when seeking solutions. It's another theme that occasionally pops up in her work as she pushes boundaries and provokes conversations. In another past interview, Dr. Denning lamented that she was sometimes disappointed when the emotion of others about a particular issue prevented a much-needed public discussion. She left DEC in 1991 to go back to academia at Georgetown University, where she taught information warfare and cyber warfare as the director of the Georgetown Institute of Information Assurance. Then she went to the Naval Postgraduate School in 2002 as a professor in the Department of Defense Analysis, where she remains today. While at Georgetown, she wrote her last book in 1999, Information Warfare and Security. amazon.com/information-warfare-security-dorothy-denning/dp/02014330036/. She said she didn't write another book after that since she was finding it too difficult to keep up with the field and didn't want to write something that would be obsolete even before it was published. Over her year, she won many of the awards that any computer scientist would be proud of, including the Ada Lovelace Award, awc-hq.org/ada-lovelace-awards.html, and the National Information System Security Award, acsac.org/ncss-winners.html. In 1995, she was named a Fellow of the Association for Computing Machinery. awards.acm.org/award_winners/denning_123951.cfm. And in 2012, she was inducted into the inaugural class of the National Cybersecurity Hall of Fame, cybersecurityhalloffame.com. As Dr. Denning officially retired at the end of 2016, I asked her if she would still be working on computer security issues. Could she actually not work after all these years of working? She said, "I'm still going to keep my office, except I'll be a professor emeritus, which means I can do what I want to do without having too much direct responsibility. I'm still actively working on several things. I'm getting ready to write something right now. But I also like to go on hikes without any noise. It clears the mind. I think any professional would love to have the career, longevity, and impact on this world that Dr. Denning has had." For more information on Dr. Dorothy E. Denning. For information about Dr. Dorothy E. Denning, check out these resources. Gary McGraw's Silver Bullet Security Podcast interviewing Dr. Dorothy E. Denning. sigital.com/podcasts/show-011/. The University of Minnesota's Charles Babbage Institute's transcripts of an interview with Dr. Denning from 2012. conservancy.umn.edu/bitstream/handle/11299/156519/oh424ded.pdf. Chapter 16. Profile. Michael Dubinsky. I'm a long-time big curmudgeon about almost all computer security products. It's hard to be anything else after seeing malware and exploitation seemingly get easier over two decades, especially with almost every new security product failing to meet its initial hype. I get paid to review computer security products for a living, and I often get pitched as many as 20 new products a day. If I see one product a year that seems like it might actually do what it says it can do and might have a significant impact on reducing risk, I get ecstatic. I often go years without seeing a capable, interesting product. My criticism often applies to my employer's products as well. With that said, I've truly been blown away by Microsoft's new Advanced Threat Analytics, ATA, product. I would love it no matter who makes it. ATA uses truly advanced event and network traffic analytics to recognize active threats, including those that many security experts thought would be difficult to detect, like pass the hash, n.wikipedia.org/wiki/pass_the_hash, or golden ticket, infoworld.com/article/2608877/security/fear-the-golden-ticket-attack-.html attacks. After watching it in action and seeing it mature over time, it's so good that I want to quit what I do for a living and solely work to promote ATA. That's not hyperbole. I would change jobs if they offered the opportunity. It's that good. Microsoft's ATA came from an acquisition of a product from an Israeli startup company called Erato in November 2014. Thousands of computer security startups get formed each year. If you've ever worked for a startup company, you know that it involves long hours, few weekends off, and a flurry of hard, exciting work surrounded by like-minded colleagues. I've known plenty of people who burned out working for startups that never took off. They risked it all for a low salary, high hour, high risk payoff that never came. My twin brother, Richard A. Grimes, often worked for early internet startups, and he once told me, "If another startup company offers to pay me in future stock, I'm going to tell them that you can't buy groceries or pay the electricity bill with future stock." Israeli Michael Dubinsky was lucky. Within half of a year of his joining Erato, it was acquired by Microsoft. Dubinsky now works for Microsoft as a product manager lead for the ATA product. He still works long hours, but he's got the comfort of a much larger corporate parent behind his efforts. Because of what it means to be Israel and Israeli, the small country has been an incredible hotbed of computer security defense products. Israeli-based companies are always creating new and advanced computer defenses. A few years ago, I was hired to teach honeypot technology to members of the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, which every Israeli must serve in for a few years. I've spent my professional career using and teaching honeypots, and I had even written a book about them. But when I showed up, it was the young men and women of the IDF who schooled me. They knew nearly everything I knew and had already used all the cool honeypot products I was going to demonstrate to them. They just needed me to help make their honeypots even more attractive and realistic. I've since learned that my experience is common to foreigners who visit the country to teach computer security defense. The Israelis grow up thinking about defenses in a way that most other countries don't have to contemplate. There were several missiles fired at Tel Aviv during the week I was visiting. I asked the class of about 20 people how many people had seen a missile fired in their direction, which, if not stopped, would have likely landed near them. Nearly every hand in the class went up. Living that way changes your priorities and perspective. It also helps make great computer security products. I asked Dubinsky if he had lived his whole life in Israel. He said, "I was born in Latvia, which is in the northern Europe, in the Baltic region. It was a part of the USSR after World War II, until it declared its independence in 1990. I moved with my parents to Israel about the same time in 1990. I grew up just south of Tel Aviv after that." I asked Dubinsky how he got into computer security. He said, "I was interested in computers as a kid, and one of my neighbors was a software engineer, and he helped a whole lot. I started messing around with computers, programming BASIC and Pascal, and disassembling stuff. Then I started finding remote access Trojans, rats, like Sub-7. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/Sub-7. They were really interesting, and I started to use them to prank friends. Using social engineering or phishing, I could get my friends to install them and then I would do pranks on them, like making the CD-ROM tray eject without them doing it. Then I progressed with friends to deciding to steal someone else's internet credentials. These were the days of dial-up modems and expensive internet use. I used my same hacker skills that I'd used to prank friends to steal someone else's internet logon credentials. I was successful, but I also got caught. My parents were very upset and they took my computer away. Later on, when I began working for the Israeli army, I worked on the computer defense side. I was especially interested in authentication and how to ensure strong authentication. I asked how he got involved with Erato. He replied, "I joined in 2014 as the 13th person in the 2-year-old company. I started right away working out engineering problems and figuring out how to build new detections and land successful POCs. There were always two main work streams going on. One side had to figure how to detect something, and the other how to make the product detect it and improve the product. I was only with Erato 6 months before Microsoft bought them out. Microsoft has given us 100% backing and trust. We are still working hard with great people and delivering a great product that is successful. I asked Dubinsky what he thinks the biggest problem in computer security is. He said, education. Eventually, most people will click on anything. No matter how much technology you build in, some people will still click on anything. Education is the key to preventing attacks. For more information on Michael Dubinsky. For information about Michael Dubinsky, check out this resource. Michael Dubinsky on Twitter. Twitter.com/MichaelDubinsky. Chapter 17. Firewalls. Firewalls are a great example of technology being a victim of its own success. Firewalls have worked so well at defending computers for 3 decades that the threats they were created to prevent have almost stopped even being tried. The bad guys are giving up, at least on those types of threats. Some experts have even argued whether firewalls are even necessary anymore. But most believe that firewalls, like anti-malware scanners, are an essential item in anyone's computer security-based configuration. What is a firewall? In a nutshell, a firewall is a software or hardware component designed to prevent unauthorized access between 2 or more security boundaries. It is traditionally accomplished by a protocol name or port number, and usually at the network level using packet filtering. Many firewalls can also allow or deny traffic based on usernames, device names, group membership, and information found in the upper levels of the application traffic. They often offer additional and advanced features such as high-level packet analysis, intrusion detection/prevention, malware detection, and VPN services. Most firewalls come with detailed log files. Turning on any firewall will usually result in a log file full of entries. The early history of firewalls. The beginning of what security experts would later identify as being an early application-level firewall was created in 1987 by AT&T Bell Labs admins Dave Presoto and Howard Tricky on a VAX computer running BSD with 2 network interfaces to protect internal users and computers. Their software allowed internal users to access the internet, but it did not allow any undefined inbound connections. They used a custom circuit-level gateway that predated the eventually very popular SOX proxy by about 7 years. It was later taken over by William Cheswick in early 1988. Note, the word firewall was used in the 1983 movie Hackers, but it wasn't clearly defined. The first mention of a firewall in technical documentation is in a 1987 presentation called The Packet Filter, an efficient mechanism for user-level network code by Jeffrey C. Mogul. He is an ACM fellow and now works at Google. research.google.com/pubs/jeffreymogul.html. Richard F. Rashid and Michael J. Aceta at an ACM Symposium on Operating Systems Principles. Cheswick's firewall-protected network was tested by the infamous November 1988 Morris Internet Worm hit, n.wikipedia.org/wiki/morris_worm. Assisted by a little luck due to previous service changes, the firewall and the computers it protected remained unaffected, while hundreds of other networks and thousands of other computers did not. It was one of the first times a firewall proved its value in overall computer security in a real-world scenario. The luck part bothered Cheswick, who updated the firewall's original configuration by adding another security boundary between the internal and external interface. He eventually renamed it ProxyD, which was the first time the word proxy was used in that sort of context. Cheswick described firewalls in a 1990 Usenix proceeding, and in 1994, with Stephen Belevin, wrote the seminal book on firewalls, Firewalls and Internet Security, Repelling the Wily Hacker. Cheswick recalls the book's surprising popularity this way. Checkpoint's Firewall Zone 1, which was eventually renamed the Checkpoint Firewall, first appeared at the Spring 1994 Las Vegas Interop, which was also within a week or so of the publication of our Firewalls book. Our publisher estimated that our book would sell 8,000 to 12,000 copies. The first printing of 10,000 copies sold out in a week, and they rushed the second printing of 20,000 out so fast, they didn't let us fix bugs. We sold about 100,000 copies total, in about a dozen languages. It came at just the right time. Brian Reed and other Digital Equipment Corporation, DEC, people were doing similar work on firewalls, interfacing DEC's corporate DEC net with the Internet. However, their firewall was a bit more focused on blocking outgoing access, as DEC had previously lost important software by unauthorized data exfiltration. Marcus Ranum wrote the first major commercial firewall product for DEC in 1990, and another version called Screening External Access Link, SEAL, along with Jeff Mulligan in 1991. At the same time, Jeffrey Mogul released ScreenD, one of the first firewalls. researchgate.net/publications/24433011_using_screend_2_implement_iptcp_security_policies. Other commercial firewalls from many different vendors followed, including TIS Gauntlet, Checkpoint, and DuPont's Raptor Eagle. Ranum made the open-source firewall toolkit in 1993 as part of a project for DARPA, the funder of the early version of the Internet, and the U.S. White House. All of this activity culminated in firewalls now being an essential component of any popular operating system. Microsoft Windows created one called the Windows Firewall, first released with Windows XP in 2001. By the second service pack in August 2004, it was turned on by default. This change is directly related to a huge drop in Windows-based malware that could have otherwise been successful. Today, many devices, including your internet router, wireless router, and cable/satellite entertainment box, contain user-configurable firewalls. Firewall rules. All firewalls have rules or policies. The most common default firewall rule is this: allow anything to go out by default, but deny any undefined inbound connections that were not previously created by an outbound connection. Very secure firewalls also restrict any previously undefined outbound traffic. Unfortunately, when very strict rules are implemented, it often causes too much operational interruption or management. And so, most implementers go with the most common default rule. Where are firewalls? Firewalls can be placed at the network level or directly on computer hosts. Network-based. Traditionally, most firewalls are located as network devices between two or more networked segments. The only thing that has changed is that the number of managed segments has increased to the point that some firewalls can manage dozens of segments at once. Today's newly emerging software-defined networks, SDNs, contain some packet-forwarding components that can directly trace their origins back to traditional firewalls. Host-based. Many people believe that even a firewall-protected network cannot be trusted. Even Cheswick infamously said that inside a network firewall's perimeter is a soft, chewy center. Cheswick was stating that we must make sure all our hosts are securely configured and hardened to help defend against things that get past the network firewall perimeter. Host-based firewalls help with that process. They normally still work at the network and packet level, but they often have additional capabilities because they are integrated with the host and its operating system. For example, the Windows firewall can be easily configured on a per-service basis and by user and group. Windows comes built-in with nearly 100 firewall rules that are enabled by the operating system even if you disable the user-controllable software application. Many computer security boundary purists believe that every host should only be able to communicate with other explicitly defined hosts, following essentially very secure, strict firewall rules that define exactly what traffic is and isn't allowed into and between all hosts. This sort of ultra-granular control is considered to be the holy grail of firewalls. Unfortunately, the complexity and management of such firewalls makes them unlikely to be widely scaled beyond some small, super-secure scenarios. Advanced firewalls. Advanced firewalls have been around for decades and usually refer to features that a traditional packet-filtering-only firewall doesn't typically offer. A traditional firewall may be able to block by protocol, by name or number, but an advanced firewall can often block by almost any detailed individual component of the protocol, sometimes called deep packet inspection. Or it can aggregate multiple packets to identify specific attacks. A traditional firewall may drop a particular number of packets, but only an advanced firewall can say you're under a distributed denial of service attack. Application-level firewalls can look at the application layers of the network and detect maliciousness or prevent it from reaching the host. For example, an advanced firewall could drop a buffer overflow sequence from reaching a web server. Advanced firewalls are so common that most firewalls are advanced to some degree. What firewalls protect against? Firewalls prevent malicious attacks originating from unauthorized network traffic. Traditionally, remote buffer overflow attacks against vulnerable services were the number one threat that firewalls prevented. But over time, services became more robust, often because their underlying operating systems became more secure by default, and firewalls made it harder for attackers to be successful using these types of attacks. Accordingly, few of the attacks today, due to the way they are implemented, would be prevented by a firewall. For example, if an end user can be tricked into running a Trojan horse program, arriving an email, there isn't much a firewall can do to prevent the subsequent maliciousness. Still, because firewalls are readily available, often free and implemented by default, and can stop certain types of attacks, most people believe every network and computing device should have one activated. You can choose to implement a firewall or not to implement one. Either way, that choice essentially points to the firewall's great success. Chapter 18 will profile one of the early main firewall creators, William Cheswick. Chapter 18. Profile. William Cheswick. As discussed in the previous chapter, William Cheswick is one of the original creators of the modern-day firewall. He took over the management of the first documented firewall, invented the circuit-level firewall, and if you say the word proxy in your computer security life, you have him to thank. Cheswick has more than a dozen patents and co-wrote the first definitive book on firewalls, Firewalls and Internet Security, Repelling the Wily Hacker. Amazon.com/firewalls-internet-security-repelling-hacker/dp/02016346-6x with Stephen Belevin in 1994. I was into firewalls before reading that book, but his book taught me much of what I know about firewalls today, and a dog-eared version of it was on my office bookshelf for nearly two decades. His infamous An Evening with Burford, in which a cracker is lured, endured, and studied, white paper, cheswick.com/ches/papers/burford.pdf, introduced many of us to honeypots. Thanks to Cheswick, the term jail is now a direct command word in FreeBSD, and a cheroot jail is one of the easiest and most popular ways to isolate particular subsystems in Unix and Linux. Few individuals have had as much broad impact on computer security boundaries as he has. He is also one of the optimistic experts I've met in the computer security field, while also realizing that a lot of things still need to be fixed. I asked Cheswick how he came to join the AT&T Bell Labs hotbed of computer security talent. He said, "In 1968, I was a chemistry guy, but I saw the first early computers, and I figured they would be becoming more popular in the future. And so I got interested in them, and eventually more into them than chemistry. Eventually, I ended up at SET, a consulting firm, as a contracted techie. We would do techie work for other companies. Over my 9 years there, I had met some of the people at Bell Labs. I love the people and the place. I could have been a janitor there and been happy. So in fall of 1987, I interviewed there. The people interviewing me were giants, gods in the field, people like Dennis Ritchie, creator of the C programming language, and Ken Thompson, co-creator of Unix along with Ritchie. I would have been completely happy just from the day of interviews, but for some reason they liked me and I became a member of their team. In one of my first days, I walked up to Dave Presotto, creator of the first firewall, and volunteered to be postmaster and take over the firewall, and he said yes. I asked the creator of the circuit-level firewall to explain what a circuit-level firewall is. He replied, "It literally recreates the traffic, bit by bit, between the two or more legs of the firewall. Every packet is reconstructed and is changed to make it appear as if every outgoing packet originated from the firewall. To everyone outside the firewall looks like the originator of all the traffic. Before that, anyone outside would see the packets as coming from the original computers they originated from. Today, every firewall does that by default." I asked Cheswick how he met his future co-author, Steve Belevan. He said, "Stephen already worked at Bell Labs before I had arrived. Dave Presotto taught me in a TCP/IP class that Stephen also attended. We became friends and were always talking about firewalls and other threats. We eventually created a packet telescope, an early packet sniffer. We had gotten a big Class A network for AT&T, and it had so many IP addresses that we couldn't even handle them. Subnetting on such a big network didn't work very well at the time. So I announced the 12 network to the internet to see what would happen. Pretty soon we had 25 megabytes of data coming in every day. Much of it ended up being death traffic from other compromised computers. We learned a lot. Stephen talked about it in his paper, There Be Dragons. academiccommons.columbia.edu/catalog/ac:126916. We eventually made the first DNS proxy because of what we learned. And from there, our book. Our book came out at the right time because there were not any books on firewalls before that, and firewalls were very popular. We sold a lot of copies and made some good money." I asked him about all his patents. "I've worked on a few myself, and they are tough to get." He said, "I would have a lot more patents if I knew what we were doing was patentable. Early on, everything seemed obvious." Obvious is a legal term that means isn't patentable, or so I thought. What we were doing seemed obvious, common sense, to me and the other 12 guys that we talked to about it. I even had patent lawyers come around and ask if what I was working on at the time was patentable. I said no, because it was obvious. Looking back, if I had just shut up, I would have a lot more seminal patents. Years later, someone else gets the patent for something you were thinking of and doing long before. I even have a few patents and copyrights that are often ignored, like for my internet maps. Cheswick.com/Ches/map/. I did. It was truly revolutionary work for the time. We even started a company, Lumetta, around mapping. Now I see my internet maps all over the place, almost always uncredited. I was at a recent conference and the speaker put up one of my internet maps, uncredited, of course, and about half the audience around me looked at me because they knew it was one of my maps. Another example is DNS proxies. I have the patent for that, but there are plenty of DNS proxies out there and they aren't paying attention to my patent. I asked him what bothers him the most about computer security. He said, "It's constantly the same old stuff that is working. Almost nothing is new. Maybe Stuxnet, but the old stuff keeps on working. We've known at least since 1979 that passwords don't work, so why are we still doing it? I'm currently working on some new password and authentication ideas." Another example was the recent DYN DDoS attacks. dyn.com/blog/dyn-analysis-summary-of-friday-october-21-attack/. It was accomplished because of all these root passwords cooked into the firmware of IoT devices. I would give a student a failing grade for putting in hard-coded passwords. They aren't even trying. Still, Cheswick thinks computer security will greatly improve. He said, "I give lots of talks around the world, and one of my go-to stump speeches is called Internet Security, I Think We're Going to Win." Here's an example of that presentation. cacr.iu.edu/events/2016/bill-cheswick-comp-sec-we-can-win.php. We are at the Model T stage of computer security. We are not really trying, but we will. Right now we have market failure, but the market will resolve it. We will have significantly better internet security in the future. A lot of people don't believe me when I say this, but we will. Other industries had the same problems early on, but grew and improved. The internet will do the same thing. I asked him what one of the major improvements will be. He replied, "I'm still amazed that we are allowed to run arbitrary software on your computer. Even with an antivirus checker, it's like running a background check on the hobos in your bathroom. Operating systems should only allow trusted and checked code to run, and this is happening. Operating systems are starting to lead the way on this already." I asked him why he thought it was taking so long to get better computer security. He said, "There are a lot of issues, but one of the main ones are all the legacy support issues. It's like having a city. All cities have legacy support issues from past development that they just can't ignore." I asked Cheswick what he was thinking about lately. He said, "One of the biggest problems is how do you measure security in software? There's been a lot of attempts. What does an accurate system of metrics even look like? One simple example is to measure the number of total network services on your network, with each one being a potential attack vector, and reducing the number means less risk. But that's far too simplistic. Another simple measure would be to measure the number of daemons running with sedutroot, which means the program is intentionally elevated to run as the most privileged security account context. Again, less would certainly be better, but again, that's too simplistic. Another way to measure the security of, let's say, an operating system or software program is how expensive is a zero-day exploit to buy on the open market. Forbes magazine wrote an article in 2012 on this. forbes.com/sites/andygreenberg/2012/03/23/shopping-4-0-days-and-price-list-4-hackers-secret-software-exploits/#43F30356033. The cost of the exploit would be a factor of how difficult it was to break into a program or operating system, and the desirability to break into that system. For example, maybe a full exploit of an OS costs $500,000. But breaking into a frequently broken into program only costs $50,000. The larger cost tells you that vendor is doing a better job at security. Everyone wants to get even a general I spoke to recently, a better measurement of whether they are doing better or worse in securing their environment. They want a number. They want to be able to show that they had a 27 last year, but this year they have a 63, and are doing demonstrably better now. The more realistic measurement is to define all the possible measurements and give them weights and then combine all those measurements into a larger metric. That's what any leader, including the general, wants. I'm thinking about that issue a lot these days. It is getting harder and harder to break into the new software these days. Even the complaints by the FBI not being able to break into something is a good sign. It is getting better. For more information on William Cheswick. For more information about William Cheswick, check out these resources. William Cheswick's website, cheswick.com/ches/index.html. Firewalls and Internet Security, Repelling the Wily Hacker, co-authored with Stephen Belevan. amazon.com/firewalls-internet-security-repelling-hacker/dp/02016346 6X. An Evening with Burford in Which a Cracker is Lured, Endured, and Studied, White Paper. cheswick.com/ches/papers/burford.pdf. Chapter 19. Honeypots. I have been intrigued by computer security honeypots ever since I read Clifford Stahl's 1989 book, The Cuckoo's Egg. amazon.com/cuckoos-egg-tracking-computer-espionage/dp/14165077/. With his identification and capture of a foreign spy. Since then, I've run up to 8 different honeypots at a time, tracking malware and hacker behavior. I'm frequently involved in professional honeypot projects, and I even wrote a book on them called Honeypots for Windows. amazon.com/honeypots-windows-books-professionals/dp/15905933159/. I believe that all companies should include one or more honeypots in their defenses. What is a honeypot? A honeypot is any system set up for the expressed purpose of being a fake system to detect unauthorized activity. A honeypot can be a computer system, a device, a network router, a wireless access point, a printer, anything the honeypot administrator wishes to deploy. A honey net is a collection of honeypots. A honeypot can be created by deploying a real but otherwise unused system or by deploying specialized honeypot software that emulates systems. The emulation can be anywhere along the Open Systems Interconnection, OSI, model layers: physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, or application, or any combination of these layers. There are many open-source and commercial honeypot options, each offering various features and realism. The buyer must beware, though. There are some honeypot products that have been around for longer than a decade, but the vast majority of honeypot offerings come and go in a few years, free or commercial, so be aware of longevity issues. Interaction. How well a honeypot system emulates or works at a particular layer determines its interaction. A low-interaction honeypot only mimics very simplistic port connections and logs them. The connecting user may or may not be offered a logon screen, but usually a successful logon isn't allowed. A medium-interaction honeypot allows the user to log on and tries to offer up a moderate but realistic experience. If it is emulating a website, often it tries to emulate a decent but fairly static website. If it does FTP emulation, the FTP site allows logons, has files that can be downloaded, and allows multiple FTP commands to be used. High-interaction honeypots mimic a real production system to the point that a hacker interacting with it should not be able to tell the difference between it and a real production asset. If it is emulating a website, the website is broad and realistic looking, with frequently updated content. Lower emulation is far easier to maintain, but sometimes the goal of the honeypot requires higher interaction. Of course, a real system offers the best emulation, but can be more difficult to configure and manage over the long term. Why use a honeypot? There are many reasons to have a honeypot, including as an early warning system to detect malware and hackers, to determine the intent of a hacker, for hacker and malware research, to practice forensic analysis. A honeypot, when appropriately fine-tuned, is incredibly low noise and high value, especially when analyzing logs or generating alerts. For example, firewall logs are always full of tens of thousands of dropped packet events every day, most of which have nothing to do with maliciousness. And even if there was a malicious probe, good luck in deciphering which one of those packets among the multitude is the one you are supposed to generate an alert on and respond to. A honeypot is a fake system, and by design, no one or thing should be attempting to connect to it. You have to spend a little time filtering out the normal broadcast traffic and legitimate connection attempts, for example, from your antivirus updating programs, patch management, and other system management tools, and so on. But once that is done, which usually takes anywhere from 2 hours to 2 days, any other connection attempt is, by definition, malicious. A honeypot is absolutely the best way to catch an intruder who has bypassed all other defenses. It sits there waiting for any unexpected connection attempt. I've met and tracked a lot of hackers and pentesters in my decades of experience. And one fact that is true is that they search and move around a network once they have gained initial access. Few hackers know which systems are or aren't honeypots, and when they move around and simply touch the honeypot, you've got them. Case in point. One of the most common attack worries is the Advanced Persistent Threats, APTs, covered in Chapter 14. They move laterally and horizontally with ease, usually without detection. But place one or more honeypots as fake web servers, database servers, and application servers, and you'll be hard-pressed not to detect an APT. Sure, you've got hackers who will simply go from their first internal compromise to a specific asset or set of assets, but that is rarely the case. Usually, even after compromising an intended primary target, they will look around. And when they look around and touch a honeypot, boom, you've got them. Or at least you know about them. I am a big fan of placing low to medium interaction honeypots around the internal environment to give early warning of a successful compromise. Catching my own Russian spy. I've deployed dozens of honeypot systems over the years, but one of my favorite stories is when I was deploying a HoneyNet at a defense contractor. The contractor was concerned about external hacking, but our honeypots quickly turned up an unauthorized insider attack. We tracked it back to a Russian data entry person in the payroll department. We already had a camera installed in the department so we could see everything that she was doing. She had inserted an unauthorized wireless card in her PC to bridge two air-gapped networks, and she was exfiltrating large amounts of private data to another external partner. After 2 days of watching and determining her intent, she was definitely going after top secret projects, we walked into the room to confront her along with corporate security. She immediately broke into tears and was such a good actress that had we not been already watching her for days, I would have believed her. She was an Uber hacker, but the payroll department had thought she was so computer illiterate that they had sent her to keyboarding school to learn how to type better. She was just one of many Russian employees that had been hired as part of a temp agency contract. In the end, all were found to be spying and dealt with accordingly. Honeypot resources to explore. The HoneyNet project, honeynet.org, is the single best place for honeypot information and forensics. Its Honeywall CD-ROM image, honeynet.org/project/Honeywall CD-ROM, is a great free all-in-one HoneyNet software for users not scared of a little Linux configuration. It is menu-driven, full of functionality, and easier to get up and running than a brand new Honeydee install. Honeydee.org is a flexible, free, open-source, feature-rich Honeypot software program, but it requires solid Linux and network skills to deploy and operate. It performs excellent broad emulation of over 100 operating systems, and it can be easily linked with other products and scripts. On the downside, it hasn't been updated in years. I think it's a good first-time honeypot for those who want to see everything that is possible. My favorite honeypot software is KF Sensor, keyfocus.net. It's a commercial product that only works on Windows computers, but the maintainer is constantly updating and improving the product. KF Sensor has its flaws, but it's feature-rich and fairly easy to set up. It has hundreds of options and customizations, and it allows logging and alerting to a variety of databases and logs. Free trial versions are available. There are many, more than 100, honeypot products out in the world. A few new ones appear on the internet every year. If you're interested in honeypots, give some of them a try. There is no doubt that every corporate entity should be running a HoneyNet of honeypots if they are interested in the earliest warning possible of a successful hacker or malware infiltration. Chapter 20 profiles Lance Spitzner, who has probably done more honeypot research than anyone. Chapter 20 Profile Lance Spitzner. Nothing makes me more frustrated than when a security geek says, "You can't patch stupid." Lance Spitzner. In the late 1980s, I read a book by Clifford Stahl called The Cuckoo's Egg. Amazon.com/cuckoos-egg-tracking-computer-espionage/dp/B0051CSCG6/. It's the story of how a 75-cent error leads an American astronomer into discovering an international spy ring. Stahl's chief investigative tool was a honeypot. The book really piqued my interest into computer security and fighting hackers. 10 years went by before I ran into another huge honeypot advocate, Lance Spitzner. Today, most consider Spitzner to be the father of modern-day computer honeypots. He wrote and published so much information on them in the 2000s, including a book, amazon.com/honeypots-tracking-hackers-lance-spitzner/dp/03211089-57, that even today, a decade later, no one has written more. Spitzner's fresh take on the subject led to my own multi-decade interest in honeypots, including my own book on them. amazon.com/honeypots-windows-books-professionals/dp/15905933-59. Spitzner's contribution to the field was to update the whole idea of honeypots and take the honeypot from being treated as a toy to instead being considered a much-needed discipline, helping develop the field of cyber intelligence. His main interest was in getting to know how and why hackers compromised organizations, something he called Know Your Enemy. He also created definitions to describe the different styles and classes of honeypots, and helped figure out, by actually deploying them, what worked and didn't work. Spitzner is a doer, and he has learned and taught by doing. He is also a great study in how someone who didn't major in computers can make a great career in computer security. He went to college and became a history major. He joined the ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps, to help pay for his studies, and after graduating, he joined the Army as an M1 A1 Abrams tank officer for 4 years. Spitzner thoroughly believes that you don't need to be a computer major to make a career in computer security. He said, "You don't need to be in or start out in computers to have a good computer security career. 20 to 30 years ago, it was easier to do because because there wasn't a standard career path like there is now. Now, I'm concerned that the field is being overly populated by highly technical computer security majors. We need more soft skills in our profession, not just people who understand bits and bytes. Many of the biggest problems we need to solve today aren't technological anymore. There must be something about tank soldiers and computer security, because I've known a handful of them through the years who are excellent at their jobs. I asked Spitzner about it. He said, "In the military, you are constantly trained to know your enemy. I was trained not only in my tank's operations, but the operations of the enemy's tanks and how they would attack our forces. I was surprised that in the computer security world, how little anyone really knew about the enemy, because I was coming from a place where we knew everything about the bad guy. It was 1997 or 1998, and no one really cared about computer security yet." I asked him to explain further about how he got into computer security full-time after his time in a tank. He replied, "While I was in my MBA program in grad school after the Army, I got sucked into the computer security world. It was a natural fit after being in a tank. I started an internship with a Unix consulting company. We got sent some firewalls to deploy, and since I was the new guy, they dumped them on me. I loved it. I got to learn about firewalls, get trained in them, and stop bad guys. It was great. After that, I spent 4 years working for Sun Microsystems' security team, securing customers around the world." I asked him how he turned his love of firewalls into a love of honeypots. He replied, "I read three things about honeypots. First, I read a paper by Dr. Fred Cohen, considered the father of computer virus defenses. n.wikipedia.org/wiki/Fred_Cohen. Second, I read Clifford Stahl's The Cuckoo's Egg. And third, I read a white paper by Bill Cheswick, An Evening with Burford in Which a Cracker is Lured, Endured, and Studied. Cheswick.com/ches/papers/burford.pdf. Bill Cheswick, profiled in Chapter 18, was one of the first firewall computer scientists and an early honeypot user. Clifford Stahl's honeypot experiences were from 1986. Bill Cheswick's was from 1991. For a long time, these two sources were all that most of us knew of honeypots. Spitzner continued, "For a long time, there were not any good honeypots out there. I had little decoding skills, so I couldn't write my own honeypot software. So I decided to deploy honeypots using real computers. I simply put a firewall, which I did know well, in front of real systems. Everything else I wrote about was from lessons I learned from doing that." Spitzner's most productive honeypot years were when he worked full-time from 2004 to 2009 for the HoneyNet project, HoneyNet.org. The HoneyNet project was sponsored by the U.S. National Intelligence Council, dni.gov/index.php/about/organization/national-intelligence-council-who-we-are. The National Intelligence Council, NIC, was established in 1979 as a strategic analysis center. It has built a team from some of the best minds in academia, government, and the private sector. The NIC has long provided expertise and collaboration on intelligence issues and has spearheaded several significant and important projects. Anyone interested in honeypots knew that the majority of the most current and up-to-date information and tools were located on the NIC site, and they still are. It is still active to this day. If you're interested in honeypots, you should spend a lot of time at the HoneyNet Project website. It was during his time working for the HoneyNet Project that Spitzner wrote most of his public information about honeypots and helped anyone who asked questions, including me. Sadly, Spitzner eventually left the HoneyNet Project and no longer focuses on honeypots. I asked him why, and he said, "Because of my work in the HoneyNet Project, I got to know the enemy very well. Since we have become so good at using technology to defend technology, I saw cyber attackers quickly adapt and target the human element. Today, hackers are progressively leveraging social engineering. When's the last time you saw a big worm? Conficker. Conficker peaked in 2009. There's a reason why we haven't seen any big worms anymore. The default technology got much better, and now the attackers go after the weakest link, the human. I saw this move and formed my own company around security awareness. SANS Institute, SANS.org, eventually acquired my company in 2010, and now it's known as SANS Securing the Human, securingthehuman.sans.org/. We have over 1,000 customers. We help them create high-impact security awareness programs. I work with our customers, hands-on in the field like always, and I also teach classes and present at conferences. In closing, I asked Spitzner what concerned him the most about computer security today. He replied, "Well, it has to do with the human component. There's still an overemphasis on the technology side and a lack of focus on the human. It's why I'm in the field. I like and believe in what I do. The bad guys have gotten so good at what they do that there is nothing to detect. No infected attachment, no malware, no rootkit. They just identify a target in accounts payable with a phishing email or a fake invoice, and they get through. Then they use legitimate tools like PowerShell to move around the network and do bad things. Antivirus and technology is not going to detect it. Ironically, the biggest blocker to human security is often other computer security professionals. There is such a focus on continuing to invest in more technology that many security professionals feel something can only be security-related if it's bits and bytes. Nothing makes me more frustrated than when a security geek says, "You can't patch stupid," meaning that you can't fix the human. As a result, little if anything is done to secure the human element, and yet we blame them for being the weakest link. It's so crazy. For more information on Lance Spitzner, check out these resources. Honeypots, Tracking Hackers. Amazon.com/honeypots-tracking-hackers-lance-spitzner/dp/03211089-57. Lance Spitzner on Twitter. Twitter.com/lspitzner. Lance Spitzner's SANS classes. SANS.org/instructors/Lance-Spitzner. Know Your Enemy White Paper. old.honeynet.org/papers/enemy/. Know Your Enemy series of white papers. honeynet.org/papers.